I'm Mike Brewer, and you are listening to The Curious Wire.
Mike, for the four listeners who don't know who you are, you want to introduce yourself and tell us what your title and the company you work for?
Well, that is a very kind lead-in. My name is Mike Brewer, and I am the Chief Operating Officer at the Radco Companies. We're both an investment company and also a multifamily operator based in Atlanta, Georgia. We have roughly 7,000 units, which is a combination of third-party and owned assets.
So I didn't think this way when I started in the industry, but over time I've evolved my thought process. And I appreciate your kindness and all the time and insight that you have provided for me. But I found myself in the last few years really reflecting on what's going on at the moment. And so the more I do that, the more I feel I could be right or could be wrong, but I've anticipated and I've gone through a thought process of what is either currently happening, what has happened, or what is going to happen. So I want to pick your brain a little bit and take us into the mind of Mike Brewer. And how does Mike Brewer look at the last year, 2023, in multifamily? And how does Mike Brewer look at what's to come in 2024?
Well, you know, I do have the benefit of being over 50 years old now. And I think if I count the first business cycle of my lifetime, I would have been too young to be participating in the business space. But let's say I've been through four business cycles. And five, if I were old enough to do business at the time. Anyway, long story short, I say with that advantage, I can look back and think about times like on the heels of the 2007-2008 crisis, right? There was this sort of, the world falls apart and no one knows what to do. And there's a lot of discovery that's going on in the marketplace from every perspective. It doesn't matter if you're an operator, you're someone trying to buy assets, you're trying to operate assets, you're trying to secure business. No one really knows what to do. And there's a lot of uncertainty in the market, especially as it relates to interest rates, right? Moving up and down. The market likes certainty. So I think like we're in a moment in time where I think we're very close to getting back to certainty. I think certainly the Fed's actions last week where he's potentially pausing rates. I know he kind of put it out there that he might have to continue to raise, but there's a little more certainty going into 2024. I think the way I'm thinking about the world right now is we've got to get through a little more messiness, get a little more certainty. And then I think in the latter part of 2024, you're going to see a thawing out of the market. You're going to start to see some transactions actually take, but the math is going to start working again, right? People are going to.
At what point do you see that?
My guess, certainly I'm relying on a lot.
Yeah.
Licking my finger and waving it into the air for those who are listening. Yeah, I think second part of 2024 is when it will start to really loosen up. And then it'll be 2025 before you see real volume return to the marketplace.
So my take is that there's two parts to it. There's the marketplace in the sense of rents and occupancy, and there's the capital markets in the sense of properties transaction. And I think the two are actually separate in this case. So, you know, if let's say interest rates come down, it will take a little bit of a lag till transactions pick up. That's but right. I don't see how that would actually impact the current state of occupancy and rent growth.
I agree with that. I think that there are, look, the headwinds are different as it relates to leasing and occupancy, right? Certainly supply coming into the marketplace. Like we sit in Atlanta, right? And we have historical deliveries coming at us, which will certainly impact our ability to grow. You know, rent trades out, trade outs are going to be throttled. I believe occupancy is going to suffer as a result of that. But there are other markets. There are some good pockets out there in the marketplace. I know where you're at. I see you reporting out on positive rent trade outs. So I think there, for the people who actually do their homework and get out into the marketplace, they're going to find opportunities to buy deals. But for fundamentals and operating properties, I think there are a few headwinds out there that we have to contend with, and they'll probably
yeah no To me, it's fascinating how many different pockets there really are. I just had a fascinating conversation with an owner based in South Carolina, and they buy small industrial properties and multifamily properties, and they transacted 42 deals in 2023. And I use a term, I said, I hope this is not insulting, but you're playing small ball. And they said 100%, and we're getting 25 to 30% return on our cash because they're flipping these properties. And the two seem to actually really go hand in hand. They're buying these smaller, older industrial properties, let's say, you know, 25,000 to 50,000 square feet. And they're like, nobody's building that anymore. So we're playing in a space where there's no new product coming on. And the same for multifamily. They're trading Class C properties, you know, 150 units or less. And there's a lot of people who are not interested in that. Yeah. So they're coming in, they're repositioning the property, and they're turning around and selling it. And they're trading at 10% cap rates. So at a 10% cap rate, the interest rates right now are not slowing them down at all.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I think that's, you know, it's when there is a lot of noise in the marketplace, I think those individuals, especially people who have been through different business cycles, look, if you know where to look, and you're willing to get your hands dirty, meaning you've got to really dig into the information that is out in the marketplace, you can find all kinds of opportunities. It doesn't matter what the environment's like, you can find opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want people's deals to struggle, but I think that they're depending on how long these interest rates stay this way and how long people can push off their loans coming due, it could get messy. And when it does get messy, at the same time, there's a lot of opportunity. I think that Radco's initial, I guess you could say birth was through a downturn, which created a lot of opportunity.
Yeah, that's right. That was on the heels of, as it relates to the multifamily space, on the heels of 07, 08, it was probably 11, 12 where we started to get real traction in there. When Lehman fell apart and we started doing workouts for Lehman, that's where it really got started. But you're right. I do think this time around, I think there's a little more regulation in the space than there was back then, and there is a tremendous increase in the cash that is sitting on the sidelines to come in and play. So this one's going to be a little bit different. I don't think there'll be the number of opportunities that there were back in 07, 08 or in 11, 12. It's just because the dynamics are slightly different. And I think lenders are potentially willing to push it down the road a little bit further than they were back then.
So you have more experience and a different vantage point than I do. My understanding of what happened in 08, 09, and this is primarily based on the book Moneyball, The Big Short.
That it
happened in the residential space. So people were being approved for loans they shouldn't have been approved for. And the story is following these firms that were tracking, or started to notice that there was an increase in default rates. And what these banks would do is they would package these mortgages together into these bonds and sell them off and sell them off and sell them off. And they started to see that the default rate was going up. And there was also, interestingly enough, adjusted rates in the residential space there. So the thought process was, well, if the default rates are going up and there's going to be increases, that's only going to go further. And then the more they investigated, they saw that the regulations were just out the window and people were being approved for loans and they were packaged at certain grades that they should not be. And they came up with this idea of like, we're going to buy insurance policies on these bonds. So if they go bad, we'll collect the value of it. And whoever was writing the insurance policies was like, sure, this is never going to happen. And of course, we know what happened. Now, when I heard that story, it was like, how could this happen again? And how could it happen in multifamily? And my take, like when I first started in 2018 in this space, like I was just thinking in operations, you know, how do we fill it up? Rent? How do we become efficient? And it's through, you know, the changing of the world and the market, it really started to think like, how do I think about, like, how does this make sense? What is going on here? And the theory that I came up with is that for a long stretch from 2020 through mid 2022, there was artificially high occupancy. There was a lot of markets. There was no evictions. There was a huge uptick in renter fraud. And then you had these boomers who never planned on selling their house that became renters. And so this, there was very limited supply, which caused the rents to go sky high.
Right.
Which I think the reaction to that was now, oh, let's build a ton more.
Right.
And now we're seeing that. So, eventually it was like, this is not sustainable. And now at the same time, interest rates were really low. So valuations were extremely high and people were overpaying for property. And they were doing it with the assumption that they're going to continue this crazy trajectory.
Right.
Like, for example, I just saw a property, I think in Roswell. Did I say that correctly in your area?
Roswell.
Yep. Roswell. A property just sold for $71 million. In 2021, it was bought for $88 million. So it just sold at a $17 million loss. The crazy thing is only 2 years before that, in 2019, it was bought for something in the 40s.
Right.
So someone bought it at 2019 and then sold it in 2021 at the peak for a crazy amount. $88 million. You could even argue $71 million would have been overpaying for it back, you know, in just that short period of time. But it just, interest rates were so low that it came too easy for people to overpay. But that overpaying in the transaction market is separate from the operation market. I'm using that term for leasing, for occupancy, for rent growth.
Yes. I think that's all exactly right. It's when money is that easy, I think all the disciplines that are necessary to make good real estate transactions go right out the window. Now, there are a handful of people, like I think your company is one of them, that are very disciplined, right, as it relates to buying and also operating. And I think those people that really win on the backside of this adversity are those people who have stuck true to their disciplines, operating disciplines and underwriting disciplines, and have not gotten out over their skis. So it's going to be, I think the next, who knows, I'm guessing 18 to 30 months. I keep saying this to our team. You are about to get an MBA in real estate, right? You are about to get an MBA in how to operate real estate in an adverse market, in adverse market conditions. And you're going to get an MBA in working with people who are going to be emotionally loaded, even when it's not your fault. You could be the best operator in the world, and you're just going to take it on the chin, because people are going to get stressed and you're the one they're going to take it out on. But it's going to be interesting the next 18 to 30 months.
Yeah. So what's clear to me right now is that the transaction, the capital markets game is right now, maybe not always, but at the moment, it's dependent on interest rates. It's not going to really pick up too much until interest rates come down, unless people are just forced to sell.
That's right.
Right. So, and forced to sell is the property struggling, or their loan is coming due and they're not in an environment to refinance. And so the next option is to sell it. So, that's another theory that I came up with. Cause again, I see what's going on. It's like, how do you try to make sense of this? And so like, why would somebody sell right now when the market is down? Right. If you would have sold a year ago, you would have made a lot. If you hold on to it another year or two, you'll make more. Why would you sell now? And it's either one, you have a mortgage that's coming due, or two, you're trying to preserve cash for bigger opportunities.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I think you're spot on.
Well, thank you. I forgot to flatter me, but I don't know how to make sense of what's going to happen in the rental market. You know, what causes rents to, I guess, start to go up? And what causes occupancy to go up? Now, on the surface and doing a fair amount of research, it looks like that a big part of it is oversupply. So markets like Austin, Phoenix, I think Nashville, where there's a ton of construction, their occupancies tend to be higher or lower and their rent growth is. And it just sort of makes sense. And if you have another market where there's no construction or very little construction, there is positive rent growth and their occupancies are higher. Now, okay, so then I get that cycle of that playing out. But even within like some markets that we have, there's certain markets where there's no construction and there's just, it's down, right? There's, I don't know the data, and I don't think anybody does except for the property management softwares, is rent collection. I think that there's a fair amount of rent collection issues. Forget the eviction part, just the collecting rent. Right? Because the weird thing that's going on here is there's been inflation and the market has been, the consumer market is, but it's not the same as it was in 2008. Like the whole crash in 2008 had to do with the individual, the consumer. And here, like, we're seeing funny things, but, like, you know, you hear all these reports that the consumer's good or they're okay. But yeah, like, I think there's certain market, that's just my hunch. You have certain markets where people are just not paying rent. Now, I don't know if that's a resident thing or if that's an operation thing.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if this speaks directly to your point there, but I do think that the longest time the government was stimulating the consumer, right? And then so there was a certain period of time where the consumer's living off of that injection, and then that stops. But there's still probably a little runway left in their personal economics, and then they've paid off all their credit cards, so now they have a little bit of extended runway because now they can dip into savings or they can dip into credit, and they can keep this little train running for a little while. And I'm not defining that timeline, but I think that we're near the very end of that, if not the end of that. And I do think that some of the pressure as it relates to rent payments is a result of not having good personal financial hygiene, and people that are, they got used to a lifestyle, right, that was supplemented, but now it's not. And guess what? Those big ticket items like car payments and rent and things of that nature, for whatever reason, are not being prioritized because there are so many other commitments. And we're just having to relearn the fundamentals of what it means to live in the world and pay your commitments, right, that you've made. So that, there's a little bit of a headwind there. And certainly eviction moratoriums have been a little bit of the, like, I hate to say it, but I think it is true that people understand how to work the system. They learn how to work the system and they do take advantage of it. So we're seeing a little bit of that as well.
So that's fascinating to me, because you would think, okay, multifamily investing, you understand the fundamentals, but going to different markets, and not to pick on your market, but everybody I talk to about Atlanta, like, it's rough.
We lead in the terms league. Of- we lead
put
the
that
league
on a t-shirt.
I'm laughing, but I'm not happy about it either.
Yeah, but for me, you know, it was, you know, fraud, understanding what fraud was, is, it changed everything. So, you know, we looked at, you know, a few years ago, Checkpoint ID, and it was just like, oh, we don't have any fraud issue. And then COVID happened. And then all of a sudden, we started getting a ton of applications of people who never visited the property. And our on-site team was being diligent. And then we started to look into that. And for me, it was like an aha moment, because we were doing, I think I could say this, we were doing something called cash for keys, where we couldn't evict people. We were offering people, we made a contract, like, we're going to wipe your balance and move out. And I was doing this study of our high balances, and it, like, hit me. They're not all equal. And it's not based on the amount that they owe us, because if you're writing it off, it's how much is their rent. So if I have a one bedroom that's $1,500 and they owe $20,000, that's not as valuable as the two bedroom that rents for $2,200 that only owes me $10,000.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good way.
So when I had this aha, I was like, whoa, we're making a mistake. We're treating these all as equal, or we're prioritizing the people with the biggest balance. Like, it should be based on what their rent amount is, because we're trying to get it back so we could re-rent it. And then that sent me down a rabbit hole, because it was, hey, why do we have so many people who moved in recently that have a balance?
Yeah, it's, oh, go ahead.
So that, like, was, so then I, then it was like doing all that manual work was like, helped me make sense of it. When someone uses someone's ID or some fake information, they don't want you to know who they are. They don't plan on paying rent, and they're going to ride it as long as they can. It's not somebody who's trying to, like, you know, they need to make $5,000 to get qualified and they make $490. So it's like, let me fudge it $100 so I get approved, and then I'm just going to pay my rent and live there.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. It's, you know, it's, to extend on that fraud conversation for just a second, if I may, in Atlanta, there are crime rings that exist, and a couple of the ways that they play themselves out is they will actually swarm a property, like overwhelm the on-site team with like 20 applications, and then they're all calling nonstop, and they're sort of force playing this emotion. And it's like, I got to get back to the consumer. I've got to help them out. So they bypass our systems, right? Or they overwhelm the systems and get people into the buildings. I've also seen, or I've heard, this has not happened to us, and I hope it doesn't, but we post for a job, right? A leasing consultant position. And somebody from this crime ring actually applies, gets the job, and facilitates the fraud from the inside. Right? It's just like every time you think you have it whipped, you just get another iteration that evolves in the fraud marketplace.
That's terrible. And I think that, well, it's scary and frustrating. I think that the biggest problem is that there's nobody to stop it. Like, there's no agency or authorities that's trying to solve this problem. And until there's a deterrent, there's a reason for them to stop trying, they're not going to.
That's right. And it's, you know, hopefully I articulate this well, but I understand that housing, if you look at it from a global perspective, housing is a problem in our country, right? There are a lot of people that can't move into an apartment or otherwise. And so they're sort of forced into these positions to, hey, look, I got to get a roof over my kid's head, and I've just got to make sacrifices, and I'm willing to commit some fraud to just hopefully get a couple months under a roof, right? So I have a hard time saying I sympathize with that, but there, you know, if I were put in that same circumstance, what would I do to protect my family? I don't know. Maybe I would make decisions like that. I don't know. But then on the other side of that equation, I just think there are opportunities, for our institutions to come together with our governments and create scenarios that, you know, reduce regulation, like, free up some of these constraints that make it difficult to construct housing in the first place. I'm not saying go crazy, but there's got to be an answer in there. And there's got to be a political will to get it done. Because part of this fraud is being driven by people who are just desperate. I believe.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we actually saw it in our nicer properties, our higher end properties with higher rents than we did with on the lower end.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, that's a fair remark. I think, you know, a lot of our assets are in that C type, asset class. So it's at the lower end of that spectrum. So.
Yeah. And okay. So that's an interesting perspective, because they can totally vary. And we've right. seen plenty of stories of the fraud come in, and then they'll like sublease it, or they'll be running some illegal business out of the apartment, or.
Yeah.
Stuff that I'm not going to repeat.
We do see that in our higher end assets. We have a handful of higher end assets, and we do see those scenarios play out there.
So in terms of, you know, it's fascinating to me. So we have a sub market where, again, when you start to like dive into these things, you try to, at least this is how, you know, you make a story to try to make sense of it.
Sure.
And so, you know, you look at this market and I'm like, oh, this is really good. There's very little construction going on here. And then, but there's a lot of vacancy. So then you try to, you know, you're trying to make sense of that and what's going to change. But then it's like, okay, what if that doesn't change, or I can't change? Like, what can I control? So in my new role, I've actually been working on this big initiative to collect the data for our expenses and then visualize it in a way that's very interesting. So we have six categories: DOE, utilities, general admin, CapEx, payroll, taxes, license, and insurance. I think those are all the categories. So I'll put them in a visual where I could see this year versus last year, and for each category. And then I also add in there the percentage of the total budget that category is. And then I'm working on summarizing our whole portfolio in all those categories. So like when I'm doing that, it says to me like, okay, what categories? Taxes and insurance is going to be really hard to change. But at the same time, I actually just posted about this. $1 billion business idea is, if you can negotiate lower tax rate, property tax for multifamily companies, like, you can make $1 billion.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
But otherwise,
they're good.
Okay. Okay, good. But it's this, the thought process, like when I'm dividing insurance, I can't control that. You can't get rid of your insurance. That's a space that I can't control. Utilities, right? So when we were doing this exercise initially, like the president thought DOE and CapEx was going to be the most important for us to tell what we're actually doing versus our budget. But actually some of those areas were down this year. DOE in some properties were doing better. Some of the surprises were utilities. Higher. Now we have to dive in and figure out why that is. CapEx was not really too much of a surprise because we have some properties that we're still doing value add and some that we're doing very little. Mm. But general admin becomes like this, like that's where everything gets kind of thrown into there. And so when you start to become more strategic, and I learned this early in my career from you about, you know, the days that a unit is vacant is money. You told me some great stories. I think it was at Equity Residential. You had a push cart and it was a 24-hour turn or less.
That's right. That's right. In our high rise buildings. Yeah. Every floor had a cart. That's right.
So, you know, this to me, I think that the ones that the properties that operate the most efficiently will, there's a lot of opportunity in 2024, even without rent growth. You know, whatever your collections are, you reduce that, right? If you're collecting 90% or 92%, you reduce that by 5%, or you increase that by 5%. That's a lot of money.
That's right. Yeah, I'm with you on the expense side. I think in the year 24 and leading into 25, I think the companies, the operating companies that differentiate themselves in the marketplace, it's always going to be about talent, but it will be the people who figure out how to optimize expenses without sacrificing a team member experience or a consumer experience. And look, we may have to make some trade-offs in 24, 25 in those two categories, meaning team members and customers, but don't do trade-offs that really sacrifice the level of service that you're providing, because then you're putting rent at risk and turnover at risk and things of that nature.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I felt this way all 2023 and even more so 2024. Retention is going to be a huge thing.
Huge. That's right.
And I think that what happened with, you know, there's a fellow in our office that has a saying, you know, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered.
It's so true. That is so true.
And I think that when there was this crazy rent growth going on, people did get crazy. Greedy and they were very aggressive on renewal. And I think that when you just do the math and in a normal environment, you're not trying to refi every year. So you shouldn't be operating like we need to get the highest rent possible. It's a formula. Everybody's property is valued the same based on your NOI.
That's right.
And NOI takes into, now the refi doesn't, because they only look at a T3, which is mind boggling in itself.
Yeah, true.
But in general, if you're looking at your T12, you can't hide those expenses. And vacancy loss is a huge expense. Concession is a huge expense. That if you reduce those, the top performing properties have the same common denominators. They have the highest retention, they have the lowest vacancy loss, and they have the lowest concessions.
That's right.
And they spend the least on turns because they have the fewest.
And my imagination tells me, and this is a pure guess on my part, but they most likely have a team that has been together for a long bit of time and they're very cohesive, right? They understand the business.
I would say that that goes first and then the results happen after that.
That's right. That's right. Where you see the real volatility is you have this tremendous turnover at the site level, right? And so you can never get this cohesive through line of operation. You're constantly chasing it because you can't get the team settled.
Yeah, it's a people-centric business and you can't change that. You're not going to have AI turn units for you.
That's right. I used to, so there's this, axiom in real estate, location, 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 but I think equally, if not more important, it's about people, people, people.
Yeah. So when they say location, location, I think that applies to all asset classes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But people, people, people is multifamily.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't think it's people, people, people when it comes to industrial or retail or.
Yeah, that's fair. In terms of operation, that is absolutely true.
So when you're planning out for 2024, you know, operational efficiency is a high priority. Do you have specific things in mind? is there something that you could share that is high priority for you, or what your two cents would be for others to focus on in 2024?
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure that everybody has a version of this, but we just went through our business enterprise mapping process. And you know, Gary Gregory, I think you were on his show recently. Gary facilitated our business enterprise mapping this year, and we sort of look at it through a couple of different lenses, a team member experience, a consumer experience, and we believe that supplier partners are a very important part of our algorithm, so to speak. So we look at it from those three buckets. We look at all of our systems and disciplines and processes and routines. We put it all up on a wall, and then we figure out where the choke points are. In other words, the experience is not very good in this area, this area, this area. And then we start to look at technologies that we can put against those choke points, or are there things I go back to this ACEO thing that I say often, like automate, centralize, eliminate, or outsource. And so we look at everything through those lenses up on a wall, and we try to either automate processes, or we try to centralize them. We're thinking a lot about centralization. We did the assistant manager portion of the centralization thing. We're starting to look toward leasing centralization, and then we'll look toward maintenance. But then there are things that we have in our organization. I'll call them sacred cows. I think that's the proper term for it, that have existed for a very long bit of time. It's like that. Well, that's the way we've always done it. Well, great, but do we need to do it at all? So we ask ourselves a lot of questions like that. And then I do think I'm very interested in outsourcing. I know there are a number of property management companies that have outsourced things offshore. That'll probably be the next real big step for us. One more thing I'd say about centralization. I mean, centralization, it's been around for like 20 years, right? People have been like equity. When I left equity 20 years ago, we were starting to centralize. But I think today we have the technologies in place that not only can you centralize, but you should start thinking about automation at the same time you're thinking about centralization. Those two things can happen concurrently, so that much of what will be centralized will be ultimately automated.
At a different time, I'll tell you of a company that I know that has a fair amount of work in a different country at a fraction of the price. But to finish up, you just came out with a book.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
What is the book called? Where can people get it? What it's about?
Thank you, by the way. That's I didn't see that coming. It's called The Daily Collective. It's, you know, I have the Multifamily Collective podcast been doing for years and years and years, and writing articles. I think I have 3,000 articles out on my website. But The Daily Collective came to me. I was jogging one day, and I'm like, and I was listening to Ryan Holiday, and he was talking about his Daily Stoic book, and I thought, I can do that. I think I can do that. It took about a year. It was a lot more work than I ever imagined. I worked with Sharon Cawthon, who's the editor of the book, and a business partner. She's just fantastic. But it took a lot of time. I'm very proud of it, but it was a lot of work.
So there's a page per day.
Page per day.
There's like a thought for the day.
You got it. Yeah. And it's really, based on, for years and years and years, I've been writing thoughts down, like, from all kinds of different disciplines and religions and philosophies and things of that nature. And I write notes on 3x5 cards. And so I pulled out all those 3x5 cards. I have like 10,000 of them, and I literally, and I just...
Is there a sequence? Like, does it build off of it, or it's each one is just, you could pick up anywhere?
You could pick up anywhere. It's an independent thought. Now there are, you'd recognize themes if you read through the book, completely. You'll recognize themes, but different stories and different quotes that I play off for those themes. So yeah, you could pick up any day of the week at any point in the book.
But January 1st is a good day to start.
You know, I have Asperger's, so it fits good with my personality to start on January the 1st. But if you got the book today, you could start today.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Mike. Always a pleasure. And I hope 2024 is great for you and the Radco company.
Well, likewise, Moshe. And I got to tell you, I want to acknowledge you for a second. You're just, I believe you're a lot younger than I am. And I've watched you over the course of the last 12 to, let's say, 18 months plus minus. Time goes by so fast anymore. But I'm just thrilled that individuals and humans like you are taking up the torch and making multifamily into the future. You're just a great ambassador for the industry, and I absolutely love your curiosity. And I try to read all your posts, but man, it comes at me sometimes like a fire hose. But you're curious, you ask good questions, and I'm just excited to see what you do over the course of time in your career.
I appreciate that. That means a lot, Mike.